This morning, I'd like to talk about the hindrances in meditation, what are called the hindrances. As mindfulness develops, we become more aware of the nature of the forces which draw us away from awareness in the present moment, in formal practice and in our also in our active life. So we might have been pulled by sensual desire or driven by anger, and with more mindfulness we become aware of the underlying nature of what is pushing or pulling us. When we're not mindful and when we don't understand the nature of these hindrances, then you know we're more caught up in the content of what it is. So you know, like my little cup of tea example from yesterday, I didn't actually realize the nature of that was sensual desire. I just was focused on the content. You know, I wanted a cup of tea, and so with mindfulness, we're able to see through the whole story, the narrative of what we think that we want, or what we think that we want to get rid of, or what's bothering us, or impeding us, or intruding on us, and recognize, you know, the nature of, you know, in those cases, desire and aversion. So attention, our cultivation of mindfulness in the body gives us this capacity to be present with, to attend to, and become aware of the nature of these forces, these what we call these hindrances, and not get hooked by them. So rather than just, you know, getting carried away in the story about I want and I don't want, we're actually attending to what's arising and what's the nature of it, and how is it manifesting in the body and the mind, and in this retreat we're focusing on particularly in the body. But of course, body and mind are not two, and that holding of the energy that's manifesting, that's kind of pulling or pushing us into unskillful speech or action, is held in the mind within a space of openness. So these hindrances, they're called hindrances because they're hindrances to our capacity to have clarity of mind and presence. They're obstacles to our tranquility and our stability of attention. And the five are sense desire, aversion, restlessness, sloth, and torpor, and doubt, and restlessness and remorse. So they're usually paired, restlessness and remorse. So how do we work with these in our meditation practice? When sense desire arises, and we notice that we're getting caught up in some kind of narrative or energetic pull, how do we deal with it? So when there's stability of mindfulness, there's a noticing of the, you know, how the mind is getting pulled. And we may get caught up in it briefly, but there's enough attention there's enough presence that we don't get totally pulled away and, you know, led down a long fantasy or story or inner conversation or drama, whatever it is. There's enough, when there's enough mindfulness, there's, we notice what's happening, and instead of getting pulled, there's a spaciousness within which we turn our attention toward the whatever's manifesting, and we observe the nature of it, and our breath, and the sense of there is a body, the presence in the body, can help us to hold this sense of presence and groundedness and spaciousness, this this presence in mindfulness. And so we turn our attention to, you know, say anger, and we notice that, as the Buddha said in the discourse, we notice the arising, we notice the passing away, we notice the arising and passing away. So we might notice it when it's arising, and in that case where we are just, you know, attentive and where we allow it to simply pass away, or we might open to it when it is more manifested, it's kind of full blown or partly blown, and then as we attend to it, as we give it space, we're noticing it pass away, and then, you know, gradually we're noticing it arise and pass away. So these hindrances are hindrances when we get caught in them. They're obstacles to our tranquility and presence of mind when we get hooked. They're also doorways to wisdom when we turn toward them and we mindfully investigate the nature of them, because then we recognize that they're not actually anything that that does impede our awareness, that we can be aware with them, we can be aware of them, and not be at the effect of them. So that's a really important thing that happens as we become more familiar with the hindrances. It changes our whole relationship with them. So rather than a story that comes to mind is this person that was attending my weekly sessions in Montreal for quite a long time would because of the causes and conditionings in his life, he would experience the arising of dread, just this sense that he called dread, and so it was a kind of aversive experience. It was fear, it was, resistance, and it wasn't, it was probably triggered by something, but there was actually nothing that was happening in the moment that was threatening. But he was being triggered, and these would just these episodes, which were very intense to him, would arise from time to time, and he said, "I dreaded the dread because it was painful," and he said, and with mindfulness practice, he began to recognize that that he could be with it, that when it arose, he could turn toward it, he could recognize it, he could open to it, and without resisting it, it would move through. It would arise, it would pass away. The resisting of these states is a way of holding on to them, because we have to hold on to something in order to push it away. So this is kind of the basic insight, or vipassana is the Pali word, vipassana is more accurately translated as seeing or looking deeply. Many of you have probably heard about vipassana meditation. So this True North Insight teaches vipassana meditation. Insight is simply an English translation of that word. And so this vipassana practice of seeing deeply into the nature, into the impermanent nature, that it arises and passes away, is liberating, is deeply liberating. So this is something that it's a deep practice, and it takes time. It takes returning again and again, remembering, you know, the sati, the mindfulness. It takes remembering that we need to turn toward it and not run away from painful emotions, or that we need to even pleasant emotions, we need to not grasp, because when we try to hold on to pleasant emotions, then that creates stress and suffering, because those also arise and pass away. So the vipassana approach, sometimes, especially in the beginning of practice, it's difficult, it's challenging to do that, because sometimes the hindrances are really strong, and our mindfulness is not so strong. So there are some different approaches that we can use. There's a simile that Bhikkhu Anālayo uses to talk about when, you know, mindfulness is strong and we recognize a hindrance quickly, or when we get caught up in it. He said it's like it's a bit like when you are walking to a place. So you have a destination and you're walking, and you meet somebody along the way. So sometimes you meet somebody along the way, and you just, you know, nod and smile, or you stop briefly and you say, you know, hello, how are you doing? Great, you know, well, look at the weather, you know, whatever. Okay, see you, bye. And that's like when mindfulness is strong, and we're maybe a little bit snagged for a moment by hindrance, but we don't get really caught up in it. But then, you know, then there are other times when we're walking to our destination, and we meet somebody, and we get drawn into a conversation, and we sit down by the side of the road, and we spend some time talking, and we totally lose track of where we were going. And so then, you know, then we need to get up and reorient ourselves and continue on our way. So there are some ways of working with these hindrances that are kind of plans of or approaches that that are really helpful when sort of that clarity of mindfulness doesn't just, you know, notice it right away. There are different metaphors when mindfulness is very present. It's like one metaphor is like a snowflake falling into the ocean, and so it just melts right away. You know, it's gone. Another metaphor is like a drop of water falling on a hot rock, just, you know, evaporates totally. So that's when our mindfulness is strong. But it's not always the case. So the first is sense desire. So just want to look at that a little bit and explore that. So what is sense desire? So sense desire is the particular kind of wanting that seeks for happiness through the six senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking. And it also includes the desire to replace unpleasant sense experiences with pleasant ones, and manifests as being distracted by a pleasant experience while meditating or caught up with wanting any time of day. So it can be a beautiful memory, it can be some, you know, wonderful music we've heard, it can be a thought of eating, of having sex, of wanting some beautiful object, and so on. And sometimes, you know, we can just get caught up in, you know, a whole world of wanting, or something needs to be a certain way. I remember when I got married, and I was already a pretty experienced practitioner at that time, but it wasn't a big wedding. It was, you know, we just had a potluck, and you know, it was in my home, but nonetheless, you know, the mind, I just saw how the mind was getting caught up in need to have this, and it needs to be like that, and what about this, and all of this wanting. And so, I mean, it's okay to plan, but it's the underlying drivenness that creates stress and suffering. So we can really get caught in this kind of wanting of things, of experiences, and so on. So it's really important as we explore these different hindrances that we recognize that these are not, it's not that these are somehow sins or that they're bad or it's evil. That's a very different mindset from the Buddhist teachings. It's what is the effect, you know, what is the effect on ourselves and on others of getting caught up in this example, wanting. And and in a way, you know, our desires, our sense desires, are natural. I read a book fairly recently called Why Buddhism is True by it's an evolutionary psychologist named Robert Wright, and it's not like Buddhism is true, the doctrine of Buddhism is, you know, but he said the Buddha was right. You know, nature doesn't care about our personal happiness and well-being and contentment and peace. You know, nature, our DNA, cares about the continuation of the species. And so there are so many drives that we have that lead us into behaviors that really don't serve our happiness, our peace, and well-being, nor really the happiness and well-being of others. So, so just because something feels natural doesn't mean it's skillful. I found that a kind of an interesting highlight about working with these energies. So just going through these to describe what they are. Aversion is the impulse to push away, hurt, or destroy. And it can manifest as anger, resentment, hatred, antagonism, fear, anxiety, tension, or boredom. And it typically appears justified, and it easily distorts our ability to make sound judgments. It can include ill will toward ourselves and feelings of guilt, blame. And it can even appear as dislike toward the meditation object, like, you know, boredom with the breath or disliking, sensing in the body and rejecting it. So it's hard to be with the meditation object. So sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor is an experience of two words that are used to describe these experiences that are subtly different. Experience of heaviness in the body, dullness in the mind, which can lead to us feeling tired, a lack of energy, and eventually to sleep. And something brought on could be by fatigue, but it also can be brought on by aversion. Aversion to mindfully observing the workings of the mind. Sometimes when something is coming in meditation practice, we're uncovering layers of the mind and habits of the mind and attitudes and assumptions and beliefs that we've been conditioned to hold in our lives, and conditioned in ways that we're not even conscious of, by our upbringing, by our education, by our society, by our experiences, and so things emerge. And sometimes when there's a resistance to wanting to know something, resistance to wanting to see something with a clarity of understanding, the mind goes to sleep. The mind wants to just turn off. And so the Buddha compared it to being imprisoned in a cramped, dark cell, unable to move freely in the bright sunshine outside. That's kind of the flavor of sloth and torpor. And then restlessness and remorse. So these hindrances are linked because they're both agitated mind states. And restlessness is an unsettled state of mind. So the mind is just bouncing around. And unable to, it's not collected, unable to focus on the meditation object. Sometimes it's called monkey mind. And so it can arise when something causes us, we dwell on something, it causes us to feel stress, anxiety, or inner turmoil. It can also be caused by a critical mind, which is always finding fault, not satisfied with things as they are, so it's connected with aversion in that way. And then remorse is experienced as a feeling of guilt or worry about something that we did in the past or something we believe we should have done and didn't do. And doubt, and the fifth is doubt. So doubt is just always a questioning of, am I doing it right? Is this the right practice for me? You know, maybe I should be doing something else. Maybe I should be chanting. Maybe I should be doing a mantra. Maybe I should be focusing more on, studying the teachings. And so just not settling on a practice. There's a Thai teacher named Ajahn Chah who taught many of the Western teachers, and he described how important it is to take the one seat. It doesn't matter if you look around. I mean, that's fine to look around and explore what are the spiritual paths that are available to us, and certainly in North America we have so many spiritual paths that are out there because of our, and the global environment, the global reality in which we're living now, different than it was at other times. But eventually, it's really important to choose away and take the one seat and focus on that and get the guidance that is needed to deeply understand the practice. And doubt can often be experienced, and by many people is experienced as self-doubt. Like, am I really able to do this practice? Can I really awaken? Can I really become free of all these ingrained habits of mind and all these emotional patterns, reactivity. So that's an obstacle or a hindrance. So the different ways of working with these hindrances. So just to repeat, sort of the primary way. And the best way and the most liberating way is to notice just the nature, to turn toward the experience. So if the mind is ruminating, wanting something, or the mind is in some kind of drama about, he did this to me and she said that to me and I'm going to do this. So those are those are grasping, sense desire, or anger, ill will, and so to turn toward it, to cut through the story, and to recognize what is the underlying force that's driving that mental rumination. And to open to that, to be present with it in the body and mind and recognize its nature and to allow it to move through. So it's not a pleasant, when we're opening to unwholesome experiences, it's not a pleasant experience. It doesn't feel pleasant. It's actually we're noticing the suffering nature of those forces, and it's also at the same time a liberating experience, and so there is a quality of joy in it, because we're seeing that this is the suffering that brings an end to suffering. This is the suffering that leads us to wisdom and freedom. So, having repeated that, there are other ways of working with sense desire, and these other ones, which I'm going to talk about a little bit. So when, say, with sense desire, we're wanting something, to reflect wisely on the impermanence of the sense experience. So, you know, if we're kind of just imagining, fantasizing about some delicious thing to eat that we, you know, we ate before and we're wanting, you know, recognizing, yes, I'll eat it, and it'll be, then it'll be gone. It's very impermanent. Or to get some object. Yes, I'm going to feel happy when I get that, you know, object, and then it'll just be an object. The little hit of you know, that little hit of happiness will you know, dissipate, and then it'll just be another object I have. And sexual desire also, you know, to reflect on, yes, this is also impermanent, and then there's another way to work with that is to reflect on, you know, there's this body that I am wanting to have as a, you know, in a sexual experience, you know, really what I'm seeing is just the surface. I'm seeing the skin, I'm seeing the package, but what if I were to take away the skin? What's underneath the skin? And you know, that hair that looks so beautiful, you know, what about that hair when I find it in my food, or my drain gets clogged and I pull out a whole bunch of hair, you know. So it's not, you know, it's this perception that we have of, you know, this desirability of this, you know, person, this experience. And I'm going to go more into this in the afternoon Dharma talk when I go into the next contemplations in the Satipatthana Sutta on the parts of the body. So there'll be a whole kind of contemplation to work with that. Aversion. So aversion can be overcome by bringing loving kindness, by if it's aversion towards somebody or anger towards somebody, by bringing to mind that, you know, this person also wants to be happy and at peace and is suffering, especially if they're acting in a way which is difficult. Loving kindness opens us to compassion. If it's ill will towards ourself, loving kindness can help us to forgive ourselves, to accept ourselves. So we can bring a loving kindness, we can also bring gratitude. We can even bring gratitude toward difficult experiences, towards sometimes when we get sick, you know, like so many of us just have this attitude, I don't have time to get sick. You know, but getting sick can be the body saying, okay, just stop. You know, you're pushing yourself too hard. And so can we be grateful even for that message from the body? Joseph Goldstein uses a nice metaphor for bringing loving kindness to feelings of aversion and ill will. He says it's like, you know, you're watching some kind of violent program on TV, and you just say, I'm just going to change the channel, you know. So change the channel, turn on the loving kindness channel, and just, you know, turn your attention towards something else that is more wholesome, more peaceful, and more joyful. So, sloth and torpor. So, working with sloth and torpor, one of the things about it is that if you don't recognize it pretty quickly, then you're asleep. Some of you have been working with sloth and torpor meditation by standing up. That's great. Another way to work with sloth and torpor is to you open your eyes. You can, you know, just take a few minutes and lift your hands up. What we're trying to do in working with sloth and torpor is to raise the energy. Lifting through the spine some more, and even looking at the sensations in the body. What does this sloth and torpor feel like in the body? Another way to work with this kind of dullness and sleepiness is to direct the mind more, rather than having a receptive mind in which we're just feeling the breath. So we can feel the breath, then we can shift attention to feeling the pressure of the body sitting on the bench or on the chair or cushion. We can feel the pressure of the hands resting on the lap, and so on. So we're bringing a more directed attention rather than simply a receptive attention, and that can energize the mind. And if you're feeling sleepy before you come into the hall, then put some cold water on your face. And in our daily lives, we can maybe not push ourselves so hard, get the rest that we need. And then restlessness or remorse. So restlessness is often has this quality of impatience. So noticing that, bringing a sense of contentment, like patience, like, okay, it's okay where I am. Whatever's happening in my meditation is what's happening in my meditation, and it's just, it's fine. This is where I am right now, and I need to be where I am. Sometimes calming the mind by counting the breath, counting the out breaths, just counting 1 to 5 or 1 to 10. And that helps to collect the mind, because the restlessness can be a lot of thoughts, and then also another way of collecting the mind using the conceptual mind is saying a word in connection with your breathing. Like in the Thai forest tradition, they use the word budo, which is it's the same word as Buddha. And so just breathing in the first syllable, bu, do, bu, do. And that can help collect the mind. And it can be, just saying the word Buddha can be also kind of inspiring and help us to rest in an attitude of more trust. So all of these, there are many different approaches. Remorse. So when we feel a lot of remorse coming up, it can be a reminder, a way of kind of helping us to remember to live with integrity, so that we don't feel regret and remorse for what we've done, to be more mindful in the moment, and to clean up the things that are lingering. So go back, and if we feel that we've spoken in a manner that's harsh, hurtful, or done something that's hurt somebody, to go back and see what can be done to make amends, to heal the relationship. And doubt is can be addressed by working with, you know, a spiritual friend, asking your questions, and then making a commitment to say, yeah, I'm just going to, you know, I've explored and I'm going to explore this, and also trusting that the Buddha, you know, said, you know, if this teaching that I'm teaching to you couldn't be realized, I wouldn't teach it. If you couldn't wake up, if there was no way to become free, if Nibbana or Nirvana was not real, then I wouldn't be talking to you about it. So, and just to end with a reminder that these hindrances they're called that because they obstruct the clarity of and stability of awareness, and they can also be doorways, because when we directly investigate their nature, we change our relationship to them and we see their impermanent, unsatisfactory, and selfless nature. So let's take a few minutes before the end of this period to just sit in silence and perhaps apply these teachings as you find that the mind is pulled or pushed in out of presence, out of awareness.